All right, thanks very much. Thanks for the opportunity. So this is work that was done with James Bonifacio, Austin Joyce, and Kurt Hinterbickler. So what I wanted to talk about today is somewhat exotic representations of the de Sitter group. In particular, I'm going to be talking about scalar fields that have certain special symmetries that I'll talk more about in detail, and also other unusual properties that don't have precise analogs in flat space-time. My motivation is the following. So whenever we write down a quantum field theory, our starting point, the building blocks that we use, are the irreducible representations of the Poincaré group. So these are our fundamental particles. Nevertheless, we know that today, to good approximation, we can approximate our universe by, in fact, a de Sitter space-time. Moreover, during inflation, certainly the isometries of de Sitter are more relevant than the isometries of Poincaré. And so you just might ask, if instead of looking at the irreducible representations of Poincaré, if we instead use the irreducible representations of the de Sitter group, what would we find? Is there going to be anything different, anything new, just by considering this other symmetry group instead? All right, so just to start at the very beginning, so of course, in flat space-time, we categorize all particles by their mass and by their spin. So for massive particles, we have that the Casimir operator P squared is always positive definite, and this positivity is really a unitarity constraint on the mass of the particle. On the other hand, for massless particles, where P squared is equal to zero, we know that by imposing both the symmetries of the Poincaré group and this massless condition, we are led almost inevitably to the notion of gauge symmetries. So at least in flat space-time, there's a relationship between masslessness and gauge symmetry. All right, so what happens instead? So this is just a very broad overview of the irreducible representations of flat space-time. What happens instead if we consider the de Sitter group? All right, and so again, I'm going to be very general here. But now let me look specifically at non-scalar and bosonic particles, just to make things a little bit simpler. So if I restrict my attention to non-scalar and bosonic particles, and I consider the massive representations, what I find is that there's a bound. And this is what's commonly known as the Higuchi bound. And it's a unitarity bound that mixes conditions on both the mass and the spin of the particle. So for massive, yes. It's just not unitary. You can show that the modes are non-normalizable. Yeah, so there are representations, they're just non-unitary. So in fact, the bound that we're about to write down is sort of the comparable bound for de Sitter space-time. So this is the Higuchi bound. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
You said they're not unitary, that assumes they interact with the positive mass particles. But if I just have, I don't know why I'm asking this.
But yeah, it's a matter of how you pick your conventions. But yeah, let me suppose that I'm going to couple it to some other sector at the end of the day. Yeah. So the comparable bound for the massive particles is we have S times S minus 1 and the mass squared relative to the Hubble squared has to be above this bound for spinning particles. So this is the analog of this. And the notable thing about the de Sitter space is that it's a bound that mixes both the spin and the mass of the particle. For massless representations, it's also a somewhat more complicated picture. And in fact, belonging to the massless representations are also what goes by the name of partially massless particles. And these satisfy the following criteria. So for both the massless and the partially massless particles, we have a constraint that m squared over h squared is equal to s times s minus 1 minus t times t plus 1, where t is what's known as the depth of the particle. And t is constrained to span from 0 to s minus 1. All right, so in particular, when you have t is equal to s minus 1, you can see this just becomes s times s minus 1, and your particle is massless, so this saturates the bound for a massless particle. On the other hand, when t is equal to 0, then you just have m squared over h squared is s times s minus 1. And that's where you're saturating this Higuchi bound here. So the range of masses that these massless or partially massless particles are allowed to have go from massless to saturating this Higuchi bound as well. All right, so like in flat space-time, the massless particles also have the gauge symmetry. In fact, it's just the usual gauge symmetry that we would expect. But in addition, these partially massless particles, even though their value of m, their value of mass, is non-zero, they also exhibit a gauge symmetry. And so it's a reduced gauge symmetry from the full gauge symmetry of the massless particle. Nevertheless, in De Sitter space-time, you're allowed to have technically massive particles that have gauge symmetry. So this is why they go by the name of partially massless. All right. What I'm going to talk about today, in fact, doesn't fall quite into either one of these categories, although we will see that they're related very much to these partially massless particles. So what I'm going to talk about are scalars in De Sitter that have specific tachyonic masses. Nevertheless, we think that, in fact, they are unitary. And the reason for that is related to the fact that these scalars exhibit certain symmetries. And interestingly, sort of the extremal example of the scalar in De Sitter is, in fact, just the usual massless scalar in De Sitter. So when you talk about a massless scalar in De Sitter, that's something that has an ordinary shift symmetry. And that, in fact, belongs to this class of scalars. But in fact, we find that there are other scalar fields which have more involved shift symmetries that exhibit all of these properties as well. So that's what I'm going to talk about. All right. So where are these coming from? How might you see them appear? Well, so let's in fact start by looking at the first partially massless particle. So the first partially massless particle appears when s is equal to 2. So that's the first particle that can saturate this Higuchi bound without having m equal to 0. So let me just look at the representations of a spin 2 particle in De Sitter, where I'm going to plot the various representations where my axes are the Hubble constant, the background value, and the mass of the particle, like so. All right, so the Higuchi bound for the massive spin 2 particle is going to be given by m squared is equal to 2h squared. So there's a line that looks like this in my plot, given by m squared is equal to 2h squared. So if I want to plot out the various representations, it's going to look something like the following. So we still have the m squared equal to 0 line. This is still a good unitary representation that propagates the usual 2 degrees of freedom. However, if I'm below this Higuchi bound, and I'm not exactly at m squared equal to 0, so that I'm at m squared is less than 2h squared, I'm in this forbidden region here. And in this region, the helicity zero mode of the massive spin 2 particle is unstable. So in fact, this is not a good unitary representation. On the other hand, if I'm above the Higuchi bound, so if I'm at m squared is greater than 2h squared, so there I'm propagating a good healthy massive spin 2 particle, which has the right number of 5 degrees of freedom. And then on the other hand, if I fall exactly on this line here, so for m squared exactly equal to 2h squared. So I've saturated this bound. And precisely on this point, I have an enhanced gauge symmetry. So in particular, I have a scalar gauge symmetry. And the scalar gauge symmetry is responsible for getting rid of the helicity zero mode of the massive spin 2 particle, so that this really only propagates 4 physical degrees of freedom exactly at this point. All right, so we can write down Lagrangians for these theories. And let me just do that quickly to orient you. So the Lagrangian for this partially massless particle, I can write it in 2 ways. So I consider it as just the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian to quadratic order, so the free part of the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian, plus a mass term, so plus a usual Fierds-Pauli mass term, h mu nu minus h squared, where the mass is precisely set to this bound here. Alternatively, I can write it in a somewhat more transparent way in terms of an invariant field strength. So I can define a field strength like in electromagnetism, which I'm going to call F mu nu lambda. Actually, let me call it F lambda mu nu, which is equal to de Sitter covariant derivative d lambda H mu nu minus covariant derivative d mu H lambda nu. And then I can write this Lagrangian equivalently in terms of this field strength, and it's going to look like the following. So it's going to be minus 1/4 F lambda mu nu, F lambda mu nu, minus F lambda mu nu, F lambda nu nu, like so. And the reason why I've written it in this way is that this field strength here is exactly invariant under this partially massless gauge symmetry. So the partially massless gauge symmetry takes the form delta H mu nu is equal to de Sitter covariant derivative d mu d nu plus H squared g mu nu and my gauge parameter alpha, like so. All right, so these Lagrangians, of course, are equal. They're both invariant. This field strength by itself is exactly invariant under this gauge transformation. So again, it's this scalar gauge symmetry that's getting rid of the helicity zero mode of the massive spin 2, which is making this a theory that propagates 4 degrees of freedom. All right, and there's one more thing that I'll write down about these partially massless particles that will be relevant. So this is a gauge symmetry, and there are conserved charges associated with the partially massless gauge symmetry. And the way that we find the conserved charges is the usual Noether method, but it's the Noether method for gauge symmetry. And in particular, the conserved charges are in one-to-one correspondence with what are known as the reducibility parameters for the theory. All right, which means you find the reducibility parameters by looking for the gauge parameter that sets the gauge transformation equal to zero. So we find the reducibility parameters by solving the equation d mu d nu plus h squared g mu nu times alpha of x is equal to zero. So we solve this equation for alpha. And in fact, to do this most transparently, it's easiest to go to the embedding space. For de Sitter. So if I consider my de Sitter space-time as the usual hyperboloid in a flat space-time, then this equation here, in fact, becomes equivalent to just partial derivative A, partial derivative B in the embedding space alpha of x is equal to zero. And we write it this way because then it's simple to solve. We see that alpha of x has to be equal to a constant, which I'll call CA, times my embedding space variable, XA, like so. All right, so there are 5 of these charges that we have, which in itself is kind of fun. You just have a scalar gauge symmetry. It turns out that there are 5 conserved charges associated with this scalar gauge symmetry. Okay, so why did I go through all this? What does this have to do with the scalar fields that I want to talk about? We're going to perform the following exercise. So let's pretend that I start out with some massive representation that's well above the Higuchi bound. So I have some particle whose mass is greater than 2h squared. So let's do this over here. All right, so let's start with a massive spin 2. So that m squared is greater than this Higuchi bound, 2h squared. And this spin 2 particle is going to propagate 5 degrees of freedom. All right, now what I want to do is I want to take the limit that the mass approaches the Higuchi bound. So I'm going to be very careful. I'm going to keep track of all my degrees of freedom. And I'm going to send m squared to the 2h squared point. And now what's going to happen is that I'm going to conserve the number of degrees of freedom when I hit the Higuchi bound. So what's going to happen is that the 5 degrees of freedom of the massive spin 2 are going to split into the 4 degrees of freedom of the partially massless spin 2 plus a scalar field.
I have a dumb question.
Yeah.
So the 5, that's spin 2, 2 vectors, 1 scalar.
Yeah. So you have, the plus or minus 2 helicities, the plus or minus 1, and the 0 as well. Yeah, and so the partially massless field is the one that's missing the 0 helicity. Okay, so we're going to send m squared to 2h squared. And what's going to happen is that our 5 degrees of freedom are going to decompose into reducible representations. Well, it's going to decompose into a reducible representation that contains the 4 degrees of freedom of the partially massless field, plus one additional scalar field. And in fact, the Lagrangian for the scalar field is going to look like the following. So it's going to look like L is minus 1/2 d phi squared. And then I'm going to have minus 1/2. And there's going to be a tachyonic mass for this scalar field. So I'm going to have minus 1/2. And then the mass is, in fact, going to be minus 4 h squared phi squared. So again, I'm only considering like free theories here. So I haven't written down any interactions. I'm just starting out with a Lagrangian for a free massive spin 2 particle, and I'm putting the mass on the Higuchi bound. And what I find is a Lagrangian for the partially massless particle, plus the Lagrangian for this tachyonic scalar as well. All right. And it turns out that at this particular mass point, this scalar enjoys a shift symmetry. And in particular, the scalar enjoys a shift symmetry of the form delta phi is equal to CA capital XA, if I write this in embedding space coordinates. So in other words, the scalar field has inherited this shift symmetry from the gauge symmetry of the partially massless field. There is a relationship between the gauge symmetry that the partially massless field enjoys and the fact that the scalar field that decouples has a shift symmetry that looks like the reducibility parameters of precisely the same gauge theory, like so. All right. So you can keep doing this. So you can do this for the higher depth and higher spin partially massless fields as well. So let me just do one more. If I consider spin 3, partially massless field, the full spectrum of the irreducible representations, what I find for a spin 3 particle, the Higuchi bound is at now m squared is equal to 6 h squared. So everything within here is unstable, except for this line here, which is the t equals 1 depth partially massless field. So here I have a line at m squared is equal to 4 h squared. But in any case, I can perform the same experiment. I can start out with a healthy massive spin 3 particle. I can take a limit that m goes to the Higuchi bound, 6h squared. And what I find in this limit is that the 7 degrees of freedom of the healthy massive spin 3 particle decouples into a partially massless spin 3 particle and a scalar field, where now the scalar field has the following Lagrangian in this case. So L is equal to minus 1/2 d phi squared. Minus 1/2, and I think this case it's 10 h squared phi squared. And now again, remarkably, at precisely this point, you can show that the scalar field enjoys a larger shift symmetry that looks like the following. So delta phi is equal to CAB XA XB, where now the CAB is just some constant symmetric traceless matrix. Like,
So the gauge invariance, it's diffeomorphism invariance or no?
It's not diffeomorphism invariance. So when you take, if you take the m goes to zero limit, or sorry, the h goes to zero limit of the partially massless symmetry, then in that case, this becomes a subset of diff. But when h is not equal to zero, this isn't a, it's not a diffeomorphism.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, good. So what we're going to argue is that, so there are various ways of seeing it, but what we're going to argue is that because you started out with a unitary representation and you move to a point where this particle is still in fact unitary, that in fact, even though this is a tachyon, the mass does have the wrong sign, nevertheless, this should belong to the unitary representations of the de Sitter group. And we have various arguments for seeing why that should be true. On the other hand, though, so on this side, including this line, we do expect everything to be unitary. It turns out that if you perform the same trick close to this line here, so started out with a particle in here that was not unitary, took a limit where you approach this T equals 1 depth partially massless particle, there your representation would split into, again, a spin 3 partially massless, but now plus a vector field, a tachyonic vector field that has a shift symmetry. We don't think that these vectors are unitary. And one way of seeing that is that you had to sort of start out in this non-unitary region, or at least pass through the non-unitary region to get to this point here. So we think everything on this side, including this line, should be unitary. But when you do these decompositions in here, you end up with non-unitary particles. Yeah.
I mean, just in the scale case, or is it hard to see that it's...
Well, so it's... the reason why, and yeah, I'll say more about this, but the reason why it's going to be unitary at this line is because it turns out that this gives you a finite number of growing modes. So it's tachyonic, you still have growing modes. There's a finite number of them, and you can use the shift symmetries to get rid of the growing modes. And away from this, it's tachyonic, but there is no shift symmetry, and so you can't use any symmetry to get rid of the modes are true. The growing modes are truly physical in that case as well. So it's really just because you have this symmetry at this point that it ends up being a unitary representation. All right. So let me just generalize this, because you can see where the pattern is going, and I have like 5 minutes. Okay. All right. So in general. If I start with the Lagrangian for a free scalar in de Sitter spacetime with some generic mass term, which I'm going to call m sub k, at the following specific values, so at m sub k squared is equal to minus k times k plus 3 times h squared, this theory is going to enjoy a shift symmetry of the following form. So it's going to enjoy a shift symmetry of the form delta phi is equal to C A1 to AK capital X1 to capital A XK, like so. All right, so the theories that we wrote down so far that emerged from these partially massless points were the K equals 0 case. So at K equals 0, you have delta phi just equal to a constant C. At k equals 1, you have delta phi is equal to CA XA, and again, these are my embedding space coordinates. At k equals 2, you have delta phi is equal to CAB XA XB, and so forth, like so. Okay, yeah, so let's talk about this issue of the tachyonic mass. So I should say you can do all of this in anti-de Sitter as well. And sure enough, if I do this in anti-de Sitter, it's going to flip the sign of the mass term. So these representations are all unitary already in anti-de Sitter. Nevertheless, we think even with the wrong sign in de Sitter, we can argue that these growing modes are not physical. All right, so one argument can look like the following. So suppose I go to flat inflationary slicing. So my metric takes the following form. It's the x squared. And I want to look at what these modes look like at late times. So at late times, the zero mode of my scalar field is going to look like the following. So phi of q equals 0 of eta as eta goes to 0 is going to go like alpha eta to the delta plus beta eta to the delta minus, where the weights delta plus and delta minus are the usual 3 halves plus or minus the square root of 9 fourths minus m squared over h squared. All right, so now if I plug in the values here, these tachyonic values, for the mass squared, what I find for the weights are the following. So I find that delta plus is going to be equal to 3 plus k, whereas delta minus is going to be equal to minus k. All right, so this mode is perfectly healthy at late times as eta goes to 0. It's precisely this mode that grows at late times, which is signaling that this is in fact a tachyonic field, which is unstable. However, if you actually calculate what the shift symmetry looks like in these coordinates, what you find is that delta phi goes like eta to the minus k, like so. So in other words, the form of the shift symmetry itself exactly matches the behavior of the growing mode. So if you treat this shift symmetry more like we treat a gauge symmetry, where you physically identify two states that are related by the shift symmetry, you would say that the growing mode was pure gauge. In other words, you could always do a shift symmetric transformation to get rid of it as well. So this is not a 100% convincing argument, but it's one argument that we have of why we think these modes might in fact be unitary. Meaning, I think you couldn't, I don't know. I don't know if you could guarantee that it would always remain equal to zero. But I mean, certainly that would be true of any tachyonic mode, potentially, yeah. Okay, so these theories wouldn't necessarily be interesting unless we could actually write down interacting theories. So the important question is, are there interactions for these shift symmetric scalars that actually preserve the shift symmetry? So we can go through one by one. At k equals to zero, because there you just have the constant shift, it's trivial to see that any P of X type of theory is an interacting theory that's going to maintain this shift symmetry at all orders. I can look also, and so I'm considering here just self-interactions and a single scalar field. So the story modifies a bit if you allow for other fields as well. All right, so what about for the k equals 1 case? So for the k equals 1 case, it's clear that any interaction I write down that has two derivatives per field is going to be invariant under this shift symmetry. So if it has two derivatives per field, then delta phi is going to be equal to 0. On the other hand, we want to write down a theory that still has second-order equations of motion. So in the case, the simplest case, this leads us to the de Sitter version of the Galileans. So that's one example of an interacting theory that maintains this k equals 1 shift symmetry. You can also ask, are there interactions that can deform the symmetry algebra? So can you write down interactions that have this symmetry plus some field-dependent terms as well? And the answer to that is yes. And basically what you find is versions of de Sitter DBI. And their cousins as well. For k equals 2, so in this case, any interactions you write down that have three derivatives per field would automatically maintain the shift symmetry here. Nevertheless, the theory would inevitably have ghosts. And so in fact, there's no known way to maintain the k equals 2 symmetry without deforming this algebra. On the other hand, if you're willing to deform the algebra, so if you're willing to add higher order terms like so, what you find is the de Sitter analog of the special Galilean. On the other hand, so in flat space time, the special Galilean is a particular linear combination of both the free and quartic Galilean theory. In de Sitter space-time, this actually has nothing to do with Galileans anymore. This is not a linear combination of the de Sitter Galileans. But what's interesting about the theory is that up to a free dimensionless constant, the shift symmetry entirely fixes what the interactions and the potential look like. So if you demand that you have a theory that's invariant under this symmetry here, this completely fixes the nonlinear theory. Well, so there's one free coefficient And that can be arbitrarily large.
But the CV, like if I took this parametrically small, you wouldn't get the Gibbs, right? If it's an effective theory, you wouldn't get the Gibbs premium.
Oh, if you include the higher derivative terms. Yeah, but I guess in that case you would need to include all, like an infinite tower of the, yeah, that's right. Okay, and then we can show that for k is greater than or equal to 3, in fact, generically, there are no, so I say generically, there might be special points, but generically speaking, there are no consistent interacting theories. All right, so just to conclude, so what we found in the case of De Sitter space-time is that you have these special scalars that are tachyonic but seem to be unitary. The shift symmetries play a very powerful role in fixing what the interactions of these theories look like, so you get just a finite number of theories that are consistent with these shift symmetries. The last thing that I'll say is that these have interesting analogs in flat space-time. So in flat space-time, this is the special class of theories that are known to exhibit enhanced soft limits that are directly related to the shift symmetries of the scalar fields. One thing that we're interested in doing is understanding what the analog of these enhanced soft limits are for cosmological correlators in De Sitter using these fields. They might also have interesting cosmological applications, and we haven't looked at any of that yet. So I'll stop. Thanks.
Okay, questions for Rachel?
Yeah, so you, it seems like you want to use the, I guess, the shift symmetry as a gauge symmetry, and the whole discussion is very reminiscent of consistency relations. And there, I guess, in order to know what's going on, you can just use consistency relation as a diagnostic. Is this something that you plan to do or you're doing maybe?
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it's certainly something that we would like to do. Yeah, so we've just started to even calculate like what the appropriate correlators for these fields would be and what the consistency relation should look like. But yeah, certainly there should be something like that that exists.
I mean, that to me is the most compelling argument to say, okay, we don't need to worry about this extra degree of freedom. It's a gauge one. Forget about it.
More questions?
Yeah, about the interaction. Let me try to see if I understand correctly. So do you mean that so that is about the scalar sector?
I say it again?
That, you know, DBI and so on. Is that, so you can also construct that the Lagrangian, for instance, for the spin 2, like which is written in terms of H mu nu or and so on for higher spins.
Okay.
Do you mean that?
So this is just for the scalar particles.
But can you reconstruct the whole theory for the
spin? No. And in fact, that's a really good and interesting question. So in fact, for like the partially massless particles, we have these no-go theorems that say that there shouldn't be consistent interacting theories. Nevertheless, it seems like their helicity zero modes allow for consistent. So we don't know, maybe there secretly is some interacting theory for the partially massless particle that we've missed that should be related to these, but we don't know. It's super interesting.
Okay, more questions?
So what changes if you go away from De Sitter and look at more realistic space-times like inflation?
Yeah,
Does anything change?
So things should change. So in fact, these theories that are very fixed, like the special Galilean, these actually can't even couple directly to a massless spin 2 particle. So it's non-trivial how you would make the De Sitter space-time dynamical. Which is what I imagine you're kind of asking about. If you know, if you don't exactly have a fixed De Sitter background, what happens to these shift symmetries? I think what we're imagining is that somehow these should be coupled to a background in a way that has to explicitly break the symmetry, but hopefully it's some kind of soft breaking, and I'm being very vague about what I mean by that, but some kind of soft breaking so that the shift symmetries aren't just completely destroyed. There's some remnant of them. But yeah, I think it's an interesting question.
Why do you say explicitly? Why isn't it spontaneously broken? If you went to inflation, yeah,
no, you could also imagine it. Yeah, I guess I'm just thinking about the low energy theory, but yeah, you could imagine a scenario where it becomes, yeah, spontaneously big.
And is this related to the stuff in flight? I mean, in flight space, you can't write down consistent theories of higher spin. I think some famous people wrote some theorems about it once.
Yeah.
And so is this related to that? And could you sort of maybe say how it is, if it is?
Yeah, so I think the best, so I think probably what this is it's some form of a no-go for interacting massive high-spin particles. So like you said, we do have these no-go theorems for massless high-spin particles. This seems to be putting constraints on how like the low-helicity modes of massive high-spin particles could interact. And so there might be some way to extrapolate this to a broader no-go for interacting massive high-spin particles. But yeah, I mean, there are interesting parallels with the high-spin particles, just that there seems to be some magic in low numbers that somehow, like, n equals 3 or k equals 3 is sort of the cutoff for where you can have consistent interacting theories.
And non-integer spins?
Oh, yeah. So there is, in fact, we're working on this now, but there should be an analogous. So for sure there are non-integer, like half-integer spin, partially massless particles. And there are indeed, spin half shift symmetric particles as well. So a lot of the story goes through for fermions as well.
Okay, any more questions? Okay, if not, let's thank the speaker again.